The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Marcia Franklin.
Well, hello, and welcome to the City Club of Boise. A welcome as well to those of you listening on Boise State Public Radio News 91.5. I'm Marcia Franklin, and I'll be your moderator today. City Club forums are made possible by the support of our series sponsors, Micron and Echelon Group. Our media partners are Boise State Public Radio, KBOI 670, the Idaho Statesman, and Peppershock Media. This particular forum is underwritten by Boise State University's School of Public Service, the Idaho Humanities Council, and Idaho State University. The late Marilyn Schuler was a founding member of the City Club, a board member for many years, and an active participant in its committees. As you know, she was also a leader in human rights. So it's only appropriate that the club honor Marilyn with a forum on human rights. Although Marilyn would likely have been embarrassed to have been in the spotlight, and it might have been a challenge to even get her to the head table, she always sat in the back at City Club forums in the listen-only section. All the money she saved by skipping lunches is now being put to great use helping others, which was her plan all along. But since she's not here, we can shine a light on her in her absence, and actually, I think she'd be delighted with our lineup today. I'd like to thank the rest of the committee members who worked on this event, Sally Long, Sue Rentz, Michael Ward, Morgan Keating, and Russ Heller. It was Sally Long who suggested Dr. Les Peirce as a possible speaker, and when she did, I knew immediately that he was the perfect person. Dr. Peirce is a leader in the field of education, and there was nothing Marilyn emphasized more in her philanthropy and her own speeches than access to education and funding for it. Plus, she knew and admired Les personally. Along those same lines, we knew Marilyn would also want us to honor young people. One of her priorities for City Club was making sure that high school students got the opportunity to attend forums. She was an avid donor to the Landmark Club, which helps defray the cost of those student lunches. And today we have students here from Renaissance High School. So welcome, students. Also today, we recognize two young women whose efforts Marilyn followed in the news and championed. Colette Raptosh, a senior at Capitol High, and Nora Heron, a freshman at Western Washington University and former student at Borah High, founded People for Unity in 2016 and organized the first women's march in Boise in January of 2017. Despite snow, more than 5,000 people turned out. Raptosh has gone on to organize more student rallies and will be attending the University of Utah, right?
Yes.
Hoping to major in political science. Heron is studying environmental policy at WWU with a minor in law, diversity, and justice. So as you can see, they're continuing on their paths. Both the committee and the board felt that both these young women exemplify the values that Marilyn stood for, and so we wanted to honor them today. Before they receive their awards, though, let's hear more from Nora and Colette about what inspires them to do this work and how it has affected them.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm so excited to be with you all here today to talk about something that I find so exciting and empowering: youth activism and changing the world. These two ideas, a little over a year and a half ago, never once came across my mind. Now, I find them the cornerstone of everything I believe in and represent. In 2017, on January 21st, at exactly 10 a.m., I saw what power two high school students could have. Students have lived their whole lives being told that they cannot make change, that they are not meant to be heard, that they are not equal to adults. But we are. Change is spurred when we are told that change is not possible. In 2016, I was sitting in my bedroom on Thanksgiving Day getting ready for dinner. My neighbor had dropped by to talk to me about my opportunity to put on the Women's March on Idaho. They told me to wait for the adults to tell me what to do, and that waiting for direction was the right way to go. I told myself that day that I would not do a single thing that they said. Not to spite them, but to show them that high school students have the power to make change if they are brave enough to take it. What they did not know when they told me not to put on the march and to wait for direction was that the Women's March on Idaho was just the beginning. I fell in love with what I was doing. My passion had drowned out any fatigue, and it did not qualify as work. It was how I wanted to spend every second of my day. My neighbor's lack in belief in me pushed me towards activism and showed me that working with the community to create a better world was what I was put on this earth to do, and I never want to stop. So I didn't. I put on the Women's March on Idaho anniversary rally. When I stood up on the Capitol steps for the second time, I was able to look at the crowd and talk about my team. I was able to say that every single member of the committee was in high school, and to assure everyone that this was proof of a better tomorrow. I specifically said, "This is proof that the future will be brighter, the future will be stronger, and that the future is worth fighting for. Until the change we call for is actual, you will see us in the streets. You will see us on the Capitol steps, in front of the White House. You will see us demanding change all over the world." As I close my speech, I want to leave you with a quote from this year's student walkout, when over 2,000 students, for the first time, exercised their own power and learned how strong they are. "If you leave here knowing anything I want it to be, that your voice will not be lost in a country of millions, your presence will not be ignored if you will it not to be, and you can create the change you wish to see in the world with your own two hands. I want to thank everyone for all their support over these last few years and for this amazing award. Marilyn Schuler has been an amazing influence within the human rights field, and to be recognized in her name is an honor. Thank you."
That was Colette Raptosh, and now we'll hear from Nora Heron.
Hi, I'm deeply honored to be standing here today and speaking on behalf of Marilyn Schuler. Her activism and her advocacy for human rights and student civic engagement continues to inspire me, and I am sure all of you here. There is a narrative that is told that young people don't care, and I want to take a moment to reflect on this misconception. Youth-led movements are not unique to this day and age and have been changing the scope of human rights for over 100 years. Some of these examples include the One Mind, One Youth movement, which began the protests at Standing Rock, the undocumented student sit-ins to influence the Obama administration to grant Dreamers reprieve, the Black Lives Matter movement, the March for Our Lives movement, and the Women's March movement, all led by young activists. These current movements and the work of human rights advocates before me inspire my activism today. These actions of youth are the exact opposite of complacency and indifference, two misconceptions about my generation. When Colette and I began this journey a year ago, the hardest part was defying the idea that young people aren't actors in the political world. We couldn't vote, so we couldn't make a difference. And we could not have been more wrong about that. These beliefs about my generation need to be critically challenged because, as we have seen, when young people mobilize, they are a force to be reckoned with. Many see us as being addicted to our phones and social media, and I challenge this and ask you to recognize the idea that we are creative and tech savvy. We use tools never fully harnessed by activists before, and we are shaping public opinion on human rights through the internet, which I would argue is a new platform for meaningful social justice dialogue and mobilization. We are fighting for something simple and basic, as activists have been for ages. We are fighting for our future, and we are fighting for a brighter future for those around us. We, together, demand climate justice. We demand justice for our underrepresented communities. We demand reproductive justice and equal opportunity for all. We demand justice for our indigenous communities and the LGBTQ community. We recognize the intersectionality of all identities and work towards a more equitable world. It is important that we have difficult conversations about issues facing us today in a nonpartisan and respectful way. And it is important that our generation be included in this conversation. We admire and recognize the work of those before us, including the incredible and powerful work of Dottie Stimson and Marilyn Schuller in their advocacy not only for human rights, but in engaging my generation, and we thank them for creating a space like this in Idaho in which we can discuss difficult issues facing us today. As Dottie Stimson would say, nothing happens until you start talking, and I hope that as Marilyn and Dottie did, we can continue to include my generation in the conversation. For if we young activists want to carry on the torch of championing human rights, we need the guidance of you to guide us. I am looking around this room, and I know that all of you are only just a sliver of the individuals in Idaho who are strong-willed, open-minded, and committed to digging in their heels to champion respect and equity in our beloved state. This gives me so much hope, and it is a source of much pride for me, the work I do, and the community I do it with. I have no doubts that we, together with my generation, can carry forward a legacy of civic engagement and meaningful advocacy work in Idaho, and I see a bright future of engaged young activists leading the way. Thank you again for having us here. It has been an honor.
For the radio audience, these two young women just received a standing ovation, well-deserved. You know, when she received the Radcliffe Medal 3 years ago, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was asked what advice she'd give young women today. Fight for the things you care about, she said, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you. I think we can agree that both these young women have done that, as did Marilyn Schuller, and will continue to do that. I know we'll all be expecting to hear more inspiring things about them in the years to come, and that they will be a force to be reckoned with. And now, City Club President Richard Newman will present Ms. Raptosh and Ms. Heron with their awards, which include a certificate and a gift card to our favorite independent bookstore, Rediscovered Books. Please join me in congratulating our first two student honorees for the Marilyn Schuller Forum on Human Rights. And I'm choked up because Marilyn would love to have seen this. And now on to our keynote speaker. One of my favorite things to do when I visit Pocatello, Idaho, is to stop in and see a woman named Idaho. Yes, that is indeed her name, and she represents so much that is unique, resilient, and even sassy about this state. At 92, she's still going strong. The last time I visited a few months ago, I had to excuse myself from our dinner to go to bed while Idaho was still talking politics. She was also a dear friend of Marilyn Schuller's. Idaho and her husband John were both integral members of the NAACP, and Idaho sat on the state's first commission on human rights. Education has been paramount in her family. All of Idaho's children went on to higher education. That includes our speaker today, who is her son. Not only that, he became a leader in the field of education. Thomas Les Peirce received his undergraduate degree from Idaho State University, as well as a master's and a doctorate of counselor education from that institution. He was the first black elected official in Idaho, serving as a Pocatello City Council member and then mayor of Pocatello. He then became the director of the Idaho Departments of Administration and Health and Welfare. And I learned today, doing an interview with him for Idaho Public Television, something I didn't know in his long and illustrious career, he's responsible for getting the geothermal energy into the Capitol building. Just one of many things that we can thank Dr. Peirce for. He went on to serve in senior administrative positions at Idaho State University and Washington State University, then went into the private sector for a while, working as partner and chief operating officer of Power Engineers, which started in Pocatello. In 1989, Peirce went back to his educational roots, becoming the vice president for college advancement at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. That's where he would spend the rest of his career, serving as executive vice president, interim president, and then president in 2000. He held that position for 15 years. During his tenure, he oversaw the addition of more than $200 million in new buildings, The college's reach was expanded to other parts of the state, and the institution was recognized for its educational philosophy, its environmentally friendly practices, its partnerships, and its competitive tuition rates. In retirement, Dr. Peirce has continued his commitment to education, serving as a commissioner on WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. He's also on the board of Heritage University, a unique educational institution headquartered on the Yakima Nation in Washington State. But he has other interests as well. Dr. Peirce likes to come back to Idaho to fish, hunt, and to play music. Indeed, after this event, he's on his way to a music jam in Lava Hot Springs. And I have it on good authority, and as you can see from the guitar on the stage here, that we may even be graced with a song today. We're so delighted he could come to Boise and be the very first keynote speaker for this Marilyn Schuler Forum on Human Rights. In fact, I can think of no one better to do that. Dr. Peirce will speak for about 20 minutes, and then, as we always do, we'll open the forum up for questions. Please write a question on one of the cards at your table, raise your hand, and someone will bring it to me. And now, Dr. Les Peirce.
It is really an honor to be here this afternoon, and I want to thank the City Club for inviting me to speak today. And it's really nice to see so many old friends. But I am particularly honored to speak at a forum that honors Marilyn Schuler. Marilyn was a friend and a colleague. She had a profound faith in humanity. She believed that there is strength in our differences, and not just in terms of race and religion, but in how we think and feel, and how our diverse experiences strengthen the fabric of our democracy. In a time of divisiveness and incivility, her life and work challenges us to recognize that the work of sustaining our American democracy requires each of us to be actively committed to participation in the civic life of our community and this nation. Until recently, it was my belief that our country and the world were making good progress in our quest for human justice and the elimination of prejudice and racism. But I've never had any illusions about the insidiousness of racism or the tenacity of prejudice and hate. After all, my parents, John and Idaho, were committed civil rights leaders here in Idaho. They joined in the work of establishing the Idaho Human Rights Commission, the Idaho Fair Housing Agency. They were founding members of the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment that helped ultimately defeat the white supremacists, the Aryan Nations. My mother tells the story of entering the Aryan Nations compound after they were defeated. The property and all of its possessions had been forfeited on order of the court. All their personal property, cars, clothes, books, artwork, towels, soap were all in place, waiting for the return of their owners. The items were so everyday, so commonplace. She found it hard to reconcile that the terrible hatred and racism of their owners. She said she could feel the presence of evil in the rooms and in the hallway. My mother entered that compound side by side with two of the greatest warriors for justice the state of Idaho has ever produced, Marilyn Schuler and Bill Wasmus, who was the director of the Coalition Against Malicious Harassment. I am reminded today of all the Idahoans over the past four decades who have stood up for human rights and civil rights. People who rode out and met the evil of white supremacy organizations, who helped establish the laws and the institutions for fairness and justice that stand today. People who had the vision and the courage and the moral compass and the faith in our democracy to recognize that racism, discrimination, homophobia, and cultural bias are cancers that will unravel the social fabric of our nation. People I have known across the state, like Hiro Shiosaki from Blackfoot, Marilyn Schuler from Boise, Bill Wasmus from Craigmont, Ida Hawkins from Coeur d'Alene, Cecil Andrus from Orfino, Frank Church from Boise, Ben Plastino from Idaho Falls, Jess Berain from Pocatello, John and Idaho Purse from Pocatello, Sue Rentz from Boise, Phil Batt from Wilder, Glenn Sealander from Boise, Liz Sullivan from Moscow, Lou Reed from Coeur d'Alene, Mamie Oliver from Boise, Bernie Eschiff from Fort Hall, Tony Stewart from Coeur d'Alene, Mike Mitchell from Lewiston, John Evans from Malad, Jerome Mapp from Boise, and so many others, and the organizations, the NAACP, and the Kootenai County Task Force, and the Idaho Legal Aid Society that made such a difference. These people and groups took action and proved that action can make a difference. They each did their part to make more and more an effort for social justice, and the state is better for it. Today, we are faced with social and political and cultural currents that seem to run counter to our long-espoused American ideals that all people are created equal, that there are inalienable rights, and as J.D. Vance said, that Americans share something bigger than race and ethnicity, our ideology, a common citizenship and a common purpose. Over time, these American ideals have been embraced by more and more nations. And for a long time, those ideals reflected our desire and expectation for a more equitable and progressive world that was grounded in the principles of equity and justice. Today, these American ideals are under attack. We are confronted with a growing division in the vision of the American dream and who has a right to sit at the great tent of democracy. And there's even division over whether it's worthwhile to share those ideas with other people from other nations. There are those who embrace corrosive forms of nationalism and tribalism defined by Yanni Applebaum as blood and soil, culture and tradition, and America defined by culture and borders and narrow interests and enemies. This new nationalism tears at the fabric of our geographically, economically, and ethnically diverse America. This new nationalism says no to immigrants, no to those who see the continual evolution of our country as good, and no to those who celebrate our common world humanity. As David Brooks recently wrote, they tell populist stories that put each person in a certain box. They assert that the way you see the world is determined by your single tribal identity. They describe societies as battlefields with one group here and another there. In so doing, they cultivate mistrust, division, and an emotional frozenness. This surprisingly virulent reaction from the new nationalists is this fear of strangers is nothing new in America's history. The last great wave of immigration produced a bitter backlash, the Chinese Exclusion Acts of 1882, and the return in 1920 of the Ku Klux Klan, which not only targeted blacks and Catholics and Jews, but other immigrants, as well as and other immigrants, mainly Southern and Eastern Europeans. Today, tensions are once again sharpened by the changing profile of the younger generation of Americans and by those who are entering America's borders. Not only are the racial and ethnical backgrounds more varied, their place in the modern post-industrial economy is unclear, but the need to ensure that they become well-educated, contributing members of our society should be very clear. Their success will be a long-term economic necessity for this country. The reality is, as our country faces a generation gap, not just of age, but of color as well. The baby boomers, of which many of us are predominantly white. As we leave the tax-paying labor force over the next 20 years, a new generation of Asian and Latino and African Americans must be there in order to take our place in the economy and to ensure to cover the taxes for our health care. They will be the people that will take care of Medicaid, but we will need them also to be doctors and nurses and ministers, mechanics and nursing home administrators. But it's not just about financial well-being of our society. Like all of the Americans who come before them, this new generation, including the new immigrants, will enrich our culture, our arts, our language, our food, and our American story in a way we could never imagine. So we are a nation that faces dramatic changes within its borders and without. And how we answer the questions, what are we going to become? Who are we? How do the newcomers and the other minorities fit in? And how will this country handle it is critical. To answer those questions, we must recognize that despite the efforts of some, we will continue to live in a world that is inextricably interconnected, financially, politically, and socially. This joining together of our global community will continue to make us more dependent on each other as global citizens. Therefore, it is, of course, essential that we do more to understand and appreciate different languages and cultures and values and traditions. And we do that by beginning, as you have today, to build dialogue strategically and to work in local communities around conversations. We must be willing to confront and recognize our own implicit bias. Today, we talk about issues of race, about political divides, growing tribalism, and the inability to see the commonalities of all of us as human beings and citizens in this democracy. These are all the binding elements of our community that we organize around. We can organize book groups, work with people in strategic conversations in our own organizations and organizing new organizations to work hard to be open to conversations, to explore who we are and others. You can discover the many new writings that are available and figure out ways to get face-to-face with people that are different from us, culturally, racially, of all backgrounds. As an educator, I am convinced that every town and city, every state, and every country must make a long-term commitment to the education of all children. As Rod Grammer, longtime local newsman, noted recently, almost 50% of the children in my home state live in poverty. And the Education Law Center gives Idaho an F for overall commitment to education. There are deep wounds in our system that must be healed. Because of institutional racism, black public school preschoolers are almost four times more likely to be suspected than white preschoolers. Black and Latino children are more likely than white students to be suspended for school for the same behaviors. More than 60 years after Brown versus the Board of Education made segregation illegal, white neighborhoods that have become resegregated are trying to break away from the integrated school systems that form their district increasingly in this country. First, we must ensure that all children start school prepared to learn. To do that, we must increase, not decrease, access to quality pre- and postnatal health care for all children. We must increase, not decrease, child nutrition programs. Many years ago, Marilyn Schuler was an effective advocate for ensuring that all Idaho children had access to public kindergarten. But now we know that isn't even enough. We must ensure that every preschooler has access to quality daycare and early childhood education. We must ensure that when our young people graduate from high school, that they are prepared to enter the world of work or to go to college. We must strengthen and increase the diversity of our teachers. We must increase the pay of our teachers. They will serve as role models for all these young people, for all of us. These children are our future. They will operate our businesses, educate our grandchildren, protect our shores, teach in our universities. They will be on the front lines facing the next cycle of challenges to our humanity and to our freedom here on this earth. But in a more personal sense, we must each make our own commitment to understand and become involved with cultures new to us in a way that sends a message that each of us are part of a community interested in knowing and understanding those that bring new and rich cultural experiences to our community, to our state, and to our country. We must believe and act on the belief, as Dr. King said, that the agony of the poor diminished the rich, and the salvation of the rich of the weak enriched the strong. We are inevitably our brother's keepers because of our interrelated structure of our existence. It is easy for us to be shaken by the new open declaration of those that would divide us, scapegoat us, the poor, the newcomers, the Muslims, the Jews, anyone who looks or sounds differently. And it's heartbreaking to think that we must refight old battles we thought were long settled. But we have come to a time in this country and in the world when we must redouble our efforts, develop new partnerships with like-minded people, commit to social justice, expand how we use media and new technologies to embrace the new generation, which are the future of our country, to open our minds and hearts to embrace inclusion rather than exclusion, and to widen the reach of our community commitment to the ideals of this democracy. I believe what Dr. King said, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. But I've come to believe it doesn't bend on its own. It took people like Dr. King and Marilyn Schuler and all those Idahoans I noted before to reach up and bend that arc a decade ago. And that, my friends, is my call to action today, that we all find the courage of a generation before, that you, me, our parents, teachers, coaches, clergy, lawmakers, grocery clerks, reach up together and lend our weight to the crucial work of bending the arc of the moral universe towards justice and a fair and welcoming America. I believe our very democracy depends on it. For as Dr. King said, in the end, we'll remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. I would like to end this talk with a song tribute to Marilyn. It is a song that me and my friends sing more and more, and I added the last verse. My heart flows on in endless song. Above earth's lamentation, I hear the real, though far off, hymn that hails a new creation. Amid the tumult and the strife, I hear the music ringing. It flows and echoes in my soul. How can I keep from singing? Although the darkness round me flows, I know the truth, it liveth. Although the night around me close, songs in the night it giveth. No one can shake my inmost calm, while to this rock I'm clinging, for love is Lord of heaven and earth. How can I keep from singing? When tyrants tremble sick with fear and hear their death knell ringing, when friends rejoice both far and near, how can I keep from singing? In prison cells and dungeons vile, my heart to them is winging. When friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing? Though times are hard, the path unclear, our bond will be unshaken. For freedom, justice, hope, and peace can never be forsaken. Though Mother Earth is on her knees, support to her we're bringing, to know we'll be their arm and arm. How can I keep from singing? In prison cells and dungeons vile, my heart to them is winging, to know we'll be their arm and arm. How can I keep from singing? Thank you. 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 Thank you.
Well, that was just wonderful. For the radio audience, you've been listening to the words and the singing voice of Dr. Les Peirce, a third-generation Idahoan and former president of Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, among his many other accomplishments. He's the keynote speaker for the inaugural Maryland Schuler Forum on Human Rights at the City Club of Boise. And now we're going to solicit your questions. I have to say, though, Les, while it's on my mind, that one of the privileges of my career as a documentarian was being on the site of the former Aryan Nations compound with your mother, with Bill Wasmith, with Marilyn Schuler, with Norm Gissell as they walked onto that compound, and we filmed that experience and for posterity. And it was really, there are no words except for what you described your mother as saying. So I'm happy to take questions. I think Dr. Peirce had everyone so entranced that they're taking a while to get up here. But while I have you here and before we start the questioning, could you expand a little bit more on your educational philosophy that you held as the president of Evergreen State College and in administrative positions at ISU and WSU, your thoughts on education? And maybe I'll parse that a little bit. We've seen lately a great emphasis on people wanting to get a higher education that directs them solely into a profession or a job. You talk a little bit about your thoughts on the value of education for that, but also more broadly.
Well, I would just say that in our country, there the role that education has played in terms of developing vocations and professions is an important role that it plays. But for many of us, the undergraduate education was ideally planned to be a liberal education that gave you a wide range of experiences in the humanities, in the sciences, and in the arts for a reason. The assumption is that while your job day-to-day is an important thing, the fundamental glue for our democracy rests with an educated populace that can make solid decisions, that have a sense of what history is, and understand and are open to the many ways of knowing and being culturally that exist in this world. And my philosophy is that the more that we can expose all of our people, not just young people, to broad ways of knowing and opportunities to learn and to experience in the classroom and with other people that are different from them, the healthier our democracy is. And that has guided my educational career. And at the Evergreen State College, it was a fantastic opportunity far beyond anything I ever would have imagined to be able to do just that.
Great. And we'll start getting into our questions. And please feel free to write a question out for Dr. Peirce. Hold up your hand and someone will bring it to me. This person writes, "It appears there's a lack of racial diversity in Boise. What is the implication of this situation, and what are the actions necessary?" And I'll just expand that to Idaho while we're at it, instead of just Boise.
Well, the challenge we have, is, I think we understand, you know, homogeneity generates a narrow way, ultimately, of thinking, of knowing the world. And, you know, diversity is about different ways of knowing and the value that we have from being exposed to difference and learning to appreciate it in friendships, in work, in our day-to-day lives. And the cost for us early on, I think that, as we all know, the history of the Aryan Nation, the group that organized that group decided, well, you know, the Northern Idaho is one of the whitest places in America. Let's go there. And, you know, the history documents the results of those actions from them. It made it easier for them to find a place, not necessarily a people that embrace them, but, you know, it's just as important to be able to be knowledgeable enough to know what's good and what's bad in your community and have the courage and the knowledge to be able to react to it. So they found a place where people just let them be. Why? Because I'm not affected by them, and I don't know any harm that's here, and it's a profound cost. I mean, what can we do about it? You know, Southern Idaho became what it was, and my family came there because of all the many things that attract people. And jobs and the railroad was a key thing that created Pocatello as a very diverse place, relatively speaking. When I grew up and when my mother grew up, the railroad allowed jobs for people that were poor that needed to have a job that was a livable wage. And as laborers, they were able to do that. Other pockets of Idaho developed in different kinds of ways because of their history. In the north, in Wallace, we had a very different kind of experience. Laborers, miners, but people that were subjected to military crushing of unions and actions that brought African-American soldiers into that area, which caused that community never to forget that experience around their union. We're a complex, rich state, but you create diversity by having people experience the warmth and the welcoming nature of people that embrace people that are different. That's how it begins.
That probably goes along with this person's comment, which is, I don't disagree with what you say must be done, but how do we do it? It's just you worked in private industry for a little bit with Power Engineers, and so obviously it sounds like industry is and jobs and economic growth is part of this.
Well, you know, we aren't. It's a fallacy to think that we just live in Idaho. We live in the world now, and our work now touches every aspect of not just this state for most jobs and for most work. And understanding the issues, our own, for example, implicit bias that we talk more and more about the things, the bias we don't even recognize. Example, I grew up in a town that was relatively diverse, but I understood that there were assumptions about people of color that existed with the white community that were based on fallacy, and they reacted as such. And it happened when I was young, and it's happened all through my life and my career. Example, a year ago, I pulled up to my house in Olympia, Washington, and a police officer had pulled someone over for a traffic stop. And my house sits over the bay and looks down on the city of Olympia. And I pulled up in my four-wheel drive and got out, and my camos and my Idaho stuff I wear all the time there, and went to my side gate to go in, and this guy's dealing with this person. He stops me, sir, can I help you? Sir, can I help you? Well, in my life, I've experienced that enough to know what, sir, can I help you? I said, no. Well, what are you doing here? And I said, I could ask you what I'm going to do here, but I said, but I don't want a confrontation with you. I live here. And then he was stymied, and then he just went back. Implicit bias. I mean, one of the important things that we need to do as a people, all of us, is to figure out ways, and there are now programs that help us explore that. But in order to be able to do that, you have to be open to be able to do that. Because our first reaction was, nothing wrong with me. I'm not like that. Like somehow just to acknowledge or understanding that all of us have it is such a critical and important thing with the growing diversity of our country. That diversity that we have is, I think, a wonderful thing, but it is the very thing that is occurring that has begun to create the issues of nationalism and particularly tribalism, because most of the research shows that there are large numbers of white males that are Christian that are convinced that they are more disadvantaged in their opportunity for work in America than are blacks and Hispanics. And if you look at the educational attainment level and look at the data, it isn't close, but it speaks to the growing fear of the changing America. Keep America great. Well, anyway.
Well, this leads into the next question, and City Club members are not shy about asking questions. Could you comment on the role that racism might have played in the election of Donald Trump?
Well, this is not a political organization, I understand, but how do you live life without being exposed to the realities of politics? You know, I alluded to, you talk about the president's base, and, you know, it is a base that is afraid. I think that we would be naive not to understand the context with which we are dealing with the changing and disturbing kind of activities that are occurring in our country. There is a sliver of America that is afraid that life as they have had it and know it will be there no more, that somehow they don't know what it is, but they know it's going to be different and it's going to happen because of the other. The reality and the demographics of who comes and who are being educated now are there. These young people, and it's both class and race. If we don't figure out a way to deal with this drug addiction deal that is decimating poor whites in rural areas all around our country, it's a horrendous thing. And just the numbers about not having educated people. In Idaho, certainly that 50% of kids that are in poverty are largely Caucasian. We know that. Well, you can't ignore that. We can't ignore that. If I were home in the state again and I was involved in civic life, I wouldn't ignore it. Why? Because what does it bode for the next generation? Not just race, just the strength of our society, the health of our democracy. It has to be dealt with. People are afraid. The galvanizing principle for they know in studies for Christian men is this fear that somehow they're being left behind or their opportunities in the future are going to be less in some way. I mean, it's and tribes come together when they are afraid. People embrace democracy when they're willing to embrace individuality and the opportunities for individuals to progress. And the tension is building around our future. And now the inversion that we're involved in regard to just even being engaged in a world that is not going to change in its mix and who we have to deal with and work with and live with. So it's a huge issue for us, not just in Idaho, not just in our country, but in our relationship to the overall world community.
This person writes, there are many nonprofits in Idaho. Most have boards that are not diverse. How do you recommend leaders recruit and encourage participation and inclusion of different voices?
Well, people have to raise the question first and do like we do when we do strategic planning all the time in earnest. The challenge we have with nonprofits, and it doesn't have anything to do with race or diversity, is that usually most of our nonprofits are created by people that have the zeal to see a problem and are taken on. Housing, hunger, and you become invested in that. And if you're successful at it, you gather like-minded people with you around that effort. And that's what creates a success. And then when you mature and get to a certain level where maybe things aren't working like they should because you aren't reaching whole categories of people that you want, it requires you then to somehow be able to open the door to new people. And none of us are very good at that. That's the reality. It takes intentionality. It takes every organization in its strategic plan should have something stated, what's our progress in this area? And the same equal sanctions or rewards should be applied to it that you apply to all the other goals that you have in your not-for-profit or your corporation. That's how.
This person writes, how do those of us on the progressive side avoid adding to the divisiveness while speaking up for human rights?
Well, you know, we progressives, I mean, progressives are a tribe too. No, I mean, think about what tribalism means. I mean, it's an important thing to understand. You know, people become zealous in our camps because of our convictions. And what we're saying is, how do you open the lines for communication so you can have the communication and to be able to talk and to break down the barriers? But more importantly, even though you aren't going to agree with someone, to be able to hear them honestly for what their ideas that they are, because so much of what we think and the assumptions we have are grounded in our fears. Not all of them, but many of them are. And so as, quote, progressives, and, you know, I was the president of the Evergreen State College. I know progressive. Any of my friends that have been there that are here, they know that. But anyway, we can become just as dogmatic as someone that you may term as being on the right or conservative. Just as dogmatic, just as locked into some point of view, and just as willing to lionize because of it. So this idea about tribalism is a great book. Is it there? I brought this book, Political Tribes, by Amy Choa. Fascinating book. Frames this issue beautifully. I would recommend that everybody read, just like we learned as kids, everybody read and read stuff on both sides to understand.
Well, that actually led into my last question. Somebody wanted to know what books you'd recommend to help bend the arc of justice toward freedom.
I'm terrible at remembering the names of actors in movies, the names of people that write the books that I love, but I love history. I mean, when I read a history book, it's like me living the experiences I've had in my life. And this book that Chernoff has written about Grant is a wonderful historical span. If you want to get back to the frame of the issues of race in America, just to say, oh, really? Oh, it's a wonderful, big, thick book to read. And there's one I'm reading. I have it with me. I'm taking it to the lab. It's called Educated. Tara Westover evidently is a story about a young woman who has really gone to great heights in her education, that was raised in Idaho with isolationist family, and her journey to her education and then her return home. So it's a coming-of-age story, I understand, but I understand powerful statements about education, what it can do, and what we learn about who we are and place and culture. So it's supposed to be great. And there are a whole bunch of them.
You'll have to drop a list and we'll put it on the internet or something.
I'll be glad to do that.
And let's take an opportunity to thank Dr. Les Peirce for coming here. His mother, as I mentioned, Idaho, is 92, right? 91 or 92. And your grandmother lived to be 102. So we're going to be hearing from Dr. Les Peirce for many years to come, and that's a good thing. So thank you very much for being the inaugural speaker for this Marilyn Schuller Forum on Human Rights. Thank you.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club event is an evening tour of the Idaho Botanical Gardens on Wednesday, June 13th, 2018. You can find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.